Blog Talk Radio.
Do you know God has called you? Do you know your purpose? Let us help you get on cue.
More about the heart of leadership than the heart of leadership. What their power does is to make sure their opinion come alive.
Welcome to the show. You're listening to On Cue. I'm your host, Eric Powell. Thanks for joining us. Friends, no matter if you are the teacher or the pupil or the mentee or the mentor, you have a role, you have a purpose in life, and you're leading that purpose. Our goal here is simple, to inspire and equip all to lead where they are. In other words, get us on cue with God's will, on cue with his calling on our lives, which is our purpose, and get others on cue with that purpose. What is cue? The CUE, it is how Nehemiah, model transformational leader, took a star, desperate, isolated people and building a wall and building a way of life in ancient Jerusalem. Ultimately, he queued them up. C is for common ground. Common ground is what we can agree on. It's the why. U, unified thought, is what is the vision we can share, the what, and E, equally yo. What is the game plan? What's the role in it, and what success look like? It's really the how. How do we work together to move that forward? So Q leadership integrates broadly biblical principles of leadership, change, communications, and using Nehemiah's model, of course, tap into your faith in order to really extract some of those key qualities in doing two things. Number one, get people to trust you. And two, get people to follow you, discipleship, in that purpose. So we always start our show with our prayer. So, Lord, thank you. You're a powerful, merciful, loving God. Thank you for this day. Lord, lead and bless this ministry, our audience, and all that are serving you. Lord, we know that this cue is your brainchild and our calling, but we honor you today by doing two things, Lord, giving you the glory and serving this generation through cue. So, Lord, you in your word, Romans 12:2, be you not transformed to this world, but be you transformed, to this world, and be transformed by renewing of your mind, and that may prove what is good and acceptable and perfect will of God. So, Lord, please do use this ministry to complete your purpose, align, equip, and transform new leaders for your glory, helping others hear the call and receive that call and raise some transformational leaders and gatekeepers in Christ's name. Amen. So, you know, our show is we have a dialogue, we have conversations about leadership in God's Word, where we equip leaders in some sense a roadmap in order to tap into faith and building that trust and discipleship and in their sphere of influence. And really we try to highlight everyday leaders who are making a difference and that can testify God's goodness in their lives. Our show is many things, but it is not to criticize, but really shine a light in truth and love. It's not to tell you what to do, provide a lens, a different lens in order to see things. And thirdly, it's not to focus on the mere symptoms of a problem, but really the root of the problem. And per se, we want to treat the infection, not the runny nose. So today, as in any day, let's pray that we be open, that we hear the Lord and not me, and have the right questions no matter what the differences are. Let's remember that this life is about love and surrender. And then there is always, of course, be differences of opinion, which you've had before, but let us do what a true transformational leader says, Dr. King. So let us agree without being disagreeable and be thought partners and have a fruitful dialogue. And so this today, it's February. What does February mean to a lot of us? You know, a couple of weeks ago was Groundhog's Day, you know, a folklore that tells us that if winter will last longer or spring will come sooner. The second thing you think about is Valentine's Day. You know, we buy flowers, candies, and presents for our sweetheart on a designated day. We have a circle of friends that we have an annual Valentine's dinner, couples dinner every year. And this year, I think it'd be our 11th or 12th year of doing it. But you know, when Valentine's Day comes, I also wonder why don't we do something special every month or every week, no matter rather than having one designated day. But although it's a wonderful notion, sometimes it may feel a little shallow and contrived and forced sometimes and empty because on one end, the giver should do something special more often, and then the receiver should not just add pressure on that giver just because the world and others are doing it. It sometimes can be seen as a pacifier, if you will, at times, and one can really mess up every other day of the month or the year. But he or she better send flowers on Valentine's Day to kind of correct things. But not to make it more of negative, but I see also parallels and notions of thought related to the entire month as we dedicate to Black History Month. And that's the subject of our show here today. Black history is vital to the fabric of America, but I wonder at times does it also feel forced or contrived or empty sometimes. In some instances, maybe a little controversial here, but it's here to throw this out and have a dialogue today, a pacifier for Black America. Black America can be ignored in every other month of the year, but we can be celebrated in February. So that's making those parallels, and that's what we want. Some of the things we want to talk about today. You know, growing up in L.A., Lower Alabama, you know, Black history was a critical part of my makeup, and I learned almost all I know of Black history about from Sunday school at Mount Zion Missionary Baptist Church in our rural community. Every Sunday school lesson had a lesson in Black history attached to it, every Sunday. And although I studied topics in school, but it was more of a repeat because I already had been exposed to this countless of weeks over my life in Sunday school. You know, with that, what is Black history and how did it get started? Of course, and I know, of course, it first started when the first slave ship set sail to the Western world. But I question, did it take a pause when after Dr. King and pick back up with Oprah? And we'll tackle some of that today and just kind of throw some provocative things out there to people to be thinking about. And you know, but what of the month though? You know, the precursor to Black History Month was created in 1926 when historian Carter G. Woodson and Associate for Study of Negro Life and History announced the second week of February to be Negro History Week. This week was chosen because it marked the birthday of both Abraham Lincoln and one of my favorites, Frederick Douglass. The expansion of Black History Month came first proposed in leaders of the Black United Students at Kent State in February 1969, and the first celebration of Black History Month took place there 1 year later in February 1970. In 76, of course, in the U.S. Bicentennial, the informal expansion of Negro History Week to Black History Month was officially recognized by the U.S. government, where President Ford, of course, urged Americans to seize the opportunity to honor too often neglected accomplishment of Black Americans in every area of endeavor throughout our history. You know, so Black History Month sparks an annual debate in lots of times about the continued usefulness or the fairness of designated month dedicated to the history of one race. Many people hold concerns about the Black history being delegated to a single month or some what we call hero worship of some of the historical figures often recognized. But regardless of the notions, positive, negatives, the question of what's the story the future generations will tell? Will this story be a dignity and triumph, a story of victimization or idleness? Will they tell the story of how leaders have failed or helped the generation? Is the key to triumph over these things around education under attack? What is the legacy of Black America? Is it a story of bondage or a story of victory in God's name? And as the Lord has done for countless of people who cried out to him, where he's raised some transformational leaders and messengers and prophets like the Nehemiahs, the Moses and Joseph, and for people who lived in disobedience. You know, which really brings our question of the day, February, Black history, or is it his story? Meaning if it's God's story, and even if it's finished yet. So to help us with that, we have we're going to be delighted to have someone with us today that I know and admire for almost 20 years now since I met my wife. She's retired. She was a tenured professor of social science and education in the Department of Educational Leadership at Jackson State University in Mississippi. She is passionate, well-learned. She's a servant. Dr. Jackie Franklin has dedicated her life to uplifting the next generation. And and I tell you, we'll all be delighted to hear from her today, and I just hope that I can contain her. No, I'm just kidding. But no, she is very passionate, and you'll be blessed to hear from her. So after the break, we'll bring on Dr. Jackie Franklin and continue our talk on February, Black History or His Story. And during the break, stay with us. Call us at 310-861-2331 if you got any questions or comments, or log in at Blog Talk Radio, and we also have a live chat there. If you feel free to press 1 on your telephone when you call in to ask questions. So friends, we'd love to hear from you. So please call us. And here's the number at 310-861-2331. This is On Cue. I'm your host, Eric Powell. We'll be right back.
By getting them on cue with God's will, by getting them on cue with His calling on their lives. Let us help you get on cue.
How powerful is your leadership? Do people trust you? Would people follow you if you were not their boss, not their parent, not their sibling, not their commanding officer? Let us help you get on the cue.
I learned more about the heart of leadership than the art of leadership. What Eric Powell does in this session is makes the leader in you come alive.
Do you know God has called you? Do you know your purpose? Let us help you get on cue.
It should be a mandatory part of every church pre-membership class, every school leadership program. I think this curriculum effectively used not only positions a person for better leadership, but positions a person for better life.
And we're back. Thanks for staying with us. You're listening to On Cue. I'm your host, Eric Powell. Remember, our mission here is simple, to equip leaders to lead where they are by getting us on cue with God's will and on cue with His purpose. So follow us on Twitter at Q Leadership throughout the week. We're taking calls, of course, as on 310-861-2331 to ask a question. Feel free to press 1 on your phone, and our producer, Kennedy, will bring you in here. So friends, we'd love to hear from you. So today's question is February. Is it Black History or His Story? We're tackling the whole notion around what is Black History and what it means to us and what it should mean to us, and as well as making the parallels to other biblical elements, especially as the God hands was in this whole movement and bringing the people out of bondage to the place where we are now, and how do we continue to complete that story. So as part of that, you know, we're delighted to have a phenomenal, phenomenal person that I've been privileged to know for about 20 years now, very insightful, very passionate, very loving, and just well learned. And so we're just happy to have Dr. Jackie Franklin. She is the retired professor at Jackson State University in Mississippi, and then a dear friend and of course, a lover of the family. So, Jackie, you here with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you very much for those kind words, Eric. I really appreciate them. I don't know if they're all true, but I really appreciate the courtesy.
Yeah, they are all true and all mine. Well, you know, I'm going to call you. Help me. Call you Jackie Franklin, Dr. Franklin.
Oh, yeah, that's fine. You know, come on, that's fine.
Normally do, right? And so, but yeah, absolutely. And we're delighted to have you. So we, you know, we've got a lot to cover. We hopefully get to mostly everything. But, you know, as I always start the show off, Dr. Franklin, what is that one word that describes you?
Well, I initially would say teacher, but what I'm going to change that and say committed. I'm a committed person. I think if anyone knows me, they know that if I identify something to be involved with, that I'll be committed to it totally. So the word that I would use to explain myself would be committed.
Committed. Yeah, we can see that in a lot of the work you've done in your entire life. You know, the second question I usually ask, and I probably shouldn't ask it, but usually ask, you know, if money was no issue, what would we be doing every day? But I think you were probably doing that already from the teacher being committed. But so I'm going to ask a different question. So nowadays, since you retire, what are you refiring with? What are you doing nowadays since retiring as a law professor?
My retirement wasn't by choice. It was because of physical needs. But I'm almost back. And what I plan to do is get more involved with the community. I think that's me. My life has been centered around community organizations, trying to help people similar to the person that I was growing up in the Seventh Ward of New Orleans, with committed parents and numerous people who were concerned about my development. I'd like to be some of those individuals. I'd like to mirror my parents and mirror many of the members of my community who really embraced me, who helped me to become the woman I am today, and for that I'm very committed. But more important than that, as a social studies teacher and as a former social studies teacher, we cannot really begin to do anything in this country without spreading the tenets of our democracy, our participatory democracy. We must teach folk that the society functions because of people. It functions because people are involved. And without involvement, we do not have a country. So community and community organizing, teaching the tenets of our community, the things that make us America. And those two things are community participation and also our capitalistic society. We need to understand what it means in order to direct our own society, in order to be in control of our lives, in order to make sure that our lives are continued fruitfully by the work that we do in terms of the market. Now, the market isn't always doesn't have to be an evil market. It can be a market similar to what Rousseau was talking about when he talked about our needing each other, the need for us to be involved with each other is the kinds of things that are going to allow us to develop from one position to the other. And so I don't know if I'm being clear, but my point would be that I would be involved with community development. I would continue to work with helping us to become, and especially young people, to become better members of our society in terms of being in control of our lives.
Yeah, so it does make a whole lot of sense, because if I were to frame it in a different way, and hopefully you agree, is, you know, you talked about the community that served and helped groom you. It's really the village. Everyone had a stake in you, and as well as others.
Yeah, and I agree with that. But let me be more clear about this. What I'm talking about is not a desire out of a feeling, but a desire out of skills and knowledge, right kinds of dispositions in order to be able to make things happen.
Right, you know, to sustain it over a period of time.
It goes beyond a desire. It goes
Absolutely.
Beyond a vision. It goes. It involves the ability to move, that is, the knowledge, the skills, and the right kind of attitudes to make things happen. And when we learn those skills, when we develop the knowledge needed in order to develop communities, then we will be better. Then we will grow. If we look at some of our communities today, they have declined basically because the people who had the skills and the knowledge and the right kinds of attitudes are gone, and we haven't replaced them.
Right.
And that's the thing that we must teach every generation, that every generation has to become better. But more importantly, they have to build on the skills that we already have.
Absolutely. You're exactly right. So we're going to jump up and pick up some of those skills, some things specifically, and in a further conversation. But as you talked about earlier about people who influence you, tell us about anybody, I guess, outside of your family and others who can influence your career over a period of time.
Well, let me start with the man who your wife's father, Dr. Joseph Pentecost. I think God had to have been with me the day I was sitting in his research class and discussing with him some of the things I wanted to do as a principal, because basically I thought that as a master teacher, and the principal is the master teacher in the school, as a master teacher I could invoke change. And it was Pentecost, Joe Pentecost, who told me and explained to me that I needed to become knowledgeable of not only what had happened in educational administration and in curriculum development, but I needed to challenge some of the things that I thought were not correct or were incorrect. And the only way I could do that was to get involved with research and to be able to document. The interesting thing about it was I started I don't want to get off on a tangent, but I started a historical society at the elementary school in Chicago, Coles Elementary. We started an Illinois Historical Society club at the school, and Joe and his students were the evaluators of the papers that my students wrote and the things that they did, all about learning about Illinois history. Now, to me, that was the epitome of what school was supposed to be. It was supposed to be involving the students. It was supposed to be interesting. It was supposed to have utility. And if we look at some of the writings of people like Herbert and Pescalozzi and Du Bois and William James and a great number of people who believed in pragmatism and humanism and in terms of teaching models, you see that they emphasized the emphasis of getting the student involved. At the time, we didn't have the kind of laws that we had now, and I was able to construct the kind of instructional plan that helped my students based on their needs. Joe Pentecost helped me to do that. In fact, I'll be forever in his debt for helping me to understand the significance of research in collaboration with trying to get students to learn.
Bear that, you know, he challenged you to be knowledgeable, understanding the past, in order for you to challenge it, in order to kind of put a plan to go in the future. Is that fair to say? As you talked
of course
about,
he did.
I'm sorry,
I'm listening.
Was that fair to say that, essentially, in order to kind of expand, in order to really be impactful of the institution you put created, to understand the past, in order you kind of challenge it, in order
of course.
To put together
he emphasized the need of our students to develop skills in writing skills, to develop skills in terms of social skills. Now, at that time, this was 1971, and there was a book in Chicago out that was really one of the worst books that I've ever seen in terms of trying to get students involved with learning. It was called My Name is Arnold. And the book was about using the term MF in terms of teaching reading. And
okay.
And it made absolutely no sense in terms of lowering the expectations of students and developing a language that would not have utility in the future. And the point that Joe was making to me at the time was that our students needed to be able to understand speech. They needed to be able to understand developing essays and developing documents. In order to do that, they needed to learn the English language. Now, in addition to that, in order to be successful, we need to deal with people. And so we need to learn, what does it mean to make a friend rather than an enemy? Now, mm-hmm. as a person who is very verbal and is sometimes misunderstood,
right.
I understood what Pentecost was telling me about the need to be much more social and to teach social skills so that people would be successful. Now, I'm still learning that lesson, but I've been taught by an expert, and I understand the errors of my ways when I make them. So those are just two examples of what I'm talking about that Pentecost helped me with. But
sure,
but
thank
Pentecost,
you. Know, I even, if you think about it, also leveraged him, if you will, you know, in a couple sense. I've watched his, when I used to visit my wife's home, I watched his lectures for two reasons. One is to kind of understand the man who I never met. Of course, he passed before we met, Todd and I met, understand who was the big influence on her life. And then number two, just to kind of understand where he was coming from. So I leveraged some of his lectures, and he talked about the whole society in a sense of four pillars. And the four pillars are political, economic, social, and education. And I, of course, kind of morphed it into my workshops, my curriculum called the Societal Ecosystem. And so, mm-hmm. and to your point, though, as I kind of see this whole notion of not having utility in order to be able to share that, you know, if you look at the world, society, and as a whole, this whole element around education, especially in your space, do you see that under attack because of not having that utility, as you talked about, of not having those social skills in order to really move or people certain for? So share more around that if you can.
Well, what I'm seeing is inability to control our lives and the ability to make decisions based on the data that we see. For example, in the beginning of the program, you talked about the significance of Black history and how it emerged in terms of historical ideas. And interestingly enough, you talked about the significance of Kent State in the history of in the development of Black history. Now, somebody wrote that history. And I have very fond feelings for Kent State and the tremendous contribution that it has made. They produce one of a teacher that and I think a lot of, and that is Dr. Darlene Hines, who was a student during that time, the 70s, when we were going through a lot of problems and challenging some of the social policies in the country. But the point I'm trying to make is that history is not accurate history. One cannot say that Black history in America was centered around the beliefs of people at Kent State regarding the development of Black history. There were too many other people in our history who gave us who made contributions to the development to the process of our developing an understanding of ourselves. But you see, we have to write the history. We have to correct the history. And if we don't correct the history, what is written by someone else, and maybe someone else's story, is given to us as our story. And so it's very important that we get involved with documenting exactly the life that we've lived. In the beginning, you talked about what is Black history. Black history is world history. It's life history, but it's life history from the lenses of the people who have lived it. As a black girl growing up in the 7th Ward of New Orleans, I could tell you a story. I could paint a story about New Orleans' 7th Ward that someone else may not have experienced or seen because they didn't see it through the lenses that I did. I knew in 1967 that there had to be some place in America that was better than the 7th Ward of New Orleans. I would have had absolutely little chance of surviving in that society. And the instructions that I had from the public schools and from my alma mater, Xavier, taught me that I could do better. But I could do better because I could frame my life. I don't know if I'm being clear.
No, you are being clear. You know, going back to the point of Kent State, you know, of ultimately it's more of around establishing the month, but you're exactly right. But from the perspective of what you use is what you shared where Dr. Pentecost challenged you to do. You got to understand the history before you challenge it, right, in order
That's
to
right. Let me give you another story.
At the end of the day. I gather you're making we're definitely aligned there. So ultimately, you talked about though the history and the lenses of people. And as I share with the show, is always try to give people a different lens on things. Not saying I'm wrong or right. It's really the questions. Always trying to try to come up with the right questions or a set of questions in order to kind of think through things. But at that point, it's research. You got to figure out the data. You got to figure out those things in order to really determine the way things should go. But, you know,
it was George Santana who talked about the need for us to understand our history and being doomed. If George Santana, he's a philosopher from Switzerland, I think. I'm not sure where his origin is. But he's given credit for that quote that if we don't understand, for people who doesn't understand their history, we'll be doomed to repeat it. Now, Santana gave us a lot of things, and he was I'm Catholic, and Santana was not Catholic. He was an atheist. But my point is that he gave us something that we could bite into in terms of understanding why our history is so important, and our history from the point of view of our experiences. I was trying to think of another person, and I'm thinking that the closest person I could come to is maybe Ida B. Wells. Ida B. Wells from Holly Springs, Mississippi, who penned the document Red Record. She kept a record of the kinds of tragedies that were happening in America, especially lynching. She literally had to flee for her life to Chicago from Memphis. She was from Mississippi, moved to Memphis, married, and had to flee to Chicago in order to survive. But my point is that what she said about the power of knowing, of knowledge, but she indicated that knowing comes from having an effective press. My question is, who do we have today? And I mean, I'm asking that question to your listeners, too, because I'm not familiar with a lot of things that are going on in this country. In fact, I'm so proud of you. I had no idea that you had a radio talk show.
Oh, no, thank you.
But Ida B. Wells tells us that the press is very important. The power of the press, now whether or not it's a press based on the electronic sounds or whether or not it's the printed word, it's important. If you don't have a people who are knowledgeable through the press, then you're in trouble.
You're right.
If we are going to survive,
to make an informed decision on what it is, what we're focused on. And so we're going to take a quick break. So after the break, We're going to pick up this whole notion of, you know, really around what is Black history, and then really trying to define and be more prescriptive on some of the challenges that you see over your entire career, and as well as how do we move this forward in the future generation. So after the break, we'll continue to talk with Dr. Jacqueline Franklin regarding February, Black history or his story. So stay with us. You can't afford to miss this. Feel free to call us at 310-861-2331 for to ask any questions or comments or of Dr. Franklin. Press 1 on your telephone if you want to ask a question, or even log into our live chat room to have a conversation if you don't want to come onto the air. So, friends, we would love to hear from you, so please call us. The number again is 310-861-2331, and Kennedy can chime in once you have a question. So this is On Cue. I'm your host, Eric Powell. We'll be right back.
Do you know God has called you? Do you know your purpose? Let us help you get on cue. How do you lead a people who are scarred, who are broken, who are helpless?
You lead them where they are by getting them on cue for God's will, by getting them on cue with His calling on their lives. Let us help you get on cue.
Who is your leadership? Do people trust you? Would people follow you if you were not their boss, not their parent, not their sibling, not their commanding officer? Let us help you get on cue.
And Dr. Franklin, and
I'm here.
Okay, and thanks for staying with us, everyone. As you listen to On Cue, I'm your host, Eric Powell, and our mission here is to help leaders leave where they are, and again, it's on cue with God's will and His purpose. And so today's question is February, Black History or His Story. We have Dr. Jacqueline Franklin, of retired professor at Jackson State University, and we've been talking about the key components around Black history. And Dr. Franklin, in a short wave, what is Black history? How would you define it in a sense?
Well, as I said earlier, I believe that Black history is world history, but it's life history for the people who are involved with it. It's the record of a people who are involved with their community, their country, the world. And it involves all of those aspects of those components that make systems operate. It's the inputs and the process and the outputs that allow systems to evolve. For example, you take human and non-human resources and you apply them in some sort of methodical way, and that's processed in a way that will deal with, you know, you talked about those four pillars that Dr. Pentecost dealt with. You apply those resources in a process that will deal politically, economically, educationally, and socially. And if those processes work and they solve problems based on the needs of the society, then we know the outputs work. We know they are satisfying. If they don't, then we know that something went wrong with either the process or that it went wrong with the resources, whether or not the resources that were human needed to be retooled for skills, for better skills, more effective skills, knowledge, or whether or not the equipment needs to be calibrated in order to deal with the realities of the needs not being solved. But systematically, we know that if the system is functional, then the things that it produces will have utility. and they will satisfy the needs of the society, the community, the family, whatever entity we're dealing with. And if they don't, then there's something that has gone wrong with either the process or the inputs. Now, Black history is a process of human behavior where we utilize these systematic activities in order to live correctly or in the manner that we wish. And when our lives are not effectively, we know that something has gone wrong with the system that we've been involved with, either the resources that we have applied to the process or the process that we have come up with in order to solve the problems. So Black history is world history, it's life history, it's the history of a people who are involved on this earth. And I say that
sincerely. Let's look at the entire of the system, and let's take process for a second. And in your perspective, you kind of outline how this works and really goes to a point of utility where it can be functional in order to be able to sustain society across those pillars or whatever those pillars are. Take the process from today's generations, past generations, future generations. What is the current state of the process? Is it functioning correctly?
That answer is not simplistic because
sure.
the problem is a lot more complex because each of those pillars or each of those aspects of society brings with it a number of entities, a number of realities that make that system function. For example, we talk about economics. Now, I'm a social studies teacher, but economics is a social science. And in order to be able to address the needs of the society in terms of the wealth, the resources, and the production of resources in order to deal with the realities of satisfying economic systems, and we have to understand what does it mean in order to grow that system. What does it mean in order to address the problems of productivity? How do we produce individuals in order to be able to become not only individuals who can provide the entities, the goods and services that we need, but also the persons who can come up with the ideas, almost like an intellectual leap, where they will dream an idea to be able to solve a problem that hasn't been created yet, because the problem is involved with the process of the economic system. I don't know if you're following me. When you address all of those individual entities in terms of economics, education, you're not dealing with simplistic problems. If you look at what the president is going through now with our Congress, our House, I mean, who would have thought that we would have a House of Representatives where, we literally cannot get the people to do what they've been placed in Washington to do, and we have not come up with an idea, an intellectual leap, to be able to address that reality. Until we can. Come up with an idea to evaluate and assess the person not doing his job, and to be able to make that to in order to help that person do his job or either replace that person. Until we can do that, the system is not going to function. It's the same with a household, where you have the members of a household who don't understand the roles that they play. And the roles are so confounded that the family becomes incapacitated because of the lack of skills, the lack of knowledge of the individuals within that entity.
Yeah, I don't know. When you look across, that's why I pick up these pillars. It's an ecosystem. You know, if one part impacts the other. You just can't one make one move on the social element and not have some impact on the economic or political or any other three pillars. So when it comes to the point of
Eric, it's more than that. It's not only within the subsystem, but between.
In between,
we
exactly.
Have,
the interface.
We have challenges within and between.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you just take one, let's take educational, for instance. I know this is a complex problem. Okay, let's take education, and which is near and dear to your heart, of course, and let's talk about the ideas that may need to make that intellectual leap, if you will, or how do we ensure that we start equipping people now in order to produce individuals in order to kind
of course,
sustain at least
and,
that
and
pillar.
Let's just take, but you know, now we have large entities that are writing curricula, that are producing curriculum guides, not based on professional input. How we got there, I really don't know. But let me just say this: the teacher is the person that is right, that is specifically involved with the student. If I use myself as an example, my teachers in elementary school knew me well enough to be able to identify experiences that would help me as the teacher. It is up to me to prepare the kind of topics and experiences that will get the interest of my children. And I know that that's easier said than done, but believe me, when you're in a class, even with 30, 25 or 30 students, and you understand the abilities of some students to help others, you understand social learning and how students can move, then you can use a variety of techniques in order to help students, in order to come up with topics or ideas to help that student learn. Then you, as the teacher, you may use a variety of strategies in terms of dealing with some students. Some students may be visual learners. They may be auditorial learners. There are a variety of learning styles that you have to consider. In addition to that, then you take that student, that third step that you would do is take that student where he or she is and then help that student to reach out and gain and go to that unknown area where you're trying to get them to go, whether or not that is teaching one of the eight parts of speech or whether or not that's teaching a social studies lesson or whether or not you're teaching a math lesson. And then fourthly, you would have that student to be able to sum up what they have learned and to be able to look at and to be able to show some sort of achievement of understanding what it is they've been taught. And then finally, you would have that student to exemplify through some sort of experience within or outside of the classroom that they understood. Now, much of what we learn, even though the presentations occur within the classroom, our abilities to really understand those ideas, those particular skills happen outside. I can tell whether or not my students have learned a particular technique in understanding voting in how they respond outside the classroom, whether
sure.
or not it's in the school's student council or whether or not it's involvement in the community with some other entity. But it's
absolutely
a combination of things.
So what I'm hearing from you is, I'm going right back to your initial comment when you talked about Dr. Pentecost. So essentially, you're doing an overall assessment, kind of understanding where the kids, how they learn, what the needs are. And then once you do the assessment, you can understand the challenge, the areas of need in order to grow that student. But, of course, thirdly, get them involved, meet them where they are in order to move forward. As you take that whole framework, those three points, When I in my work every day outside of this is ultimately I provide a lot of corporate strategy to corporations and big transformations and so forth and energy and infrastructure. And what I found so often that when big things fail, because metrics incent the wrong behaviors, right? When you start with metrics and numbers and not necessarily what you really decisions need to make on a certain student or in a certain program within the organizations, but if you just really just trying to meet those metrics, it causes all sorts of problems, as we kind of talked about today. So this leads to my question of, you know, when I grew up, it was about being well learned, not necessarily teaching to a test. Would you agree to that? Or is that something you cover?
I think teaching to the test doesn't make sense at all. You can tell whether or not, you know, my father and some of my teachers would have us to write. You could tell whether or not a student has learned a particular process by having that student exemplify whether or not they understand the process.
Sure.
I remember something happened, and I won't call names, but something happened about 10 years ago. And my oldest brother taught me a lesson. And my oldest brother was a math teacher for years. He's been retired. And something happened in the classroom, and a student decided they had the teacher to look at their paper. The teacher looked at the paper and gave the appearance or gave the child the appearance that the responses were in error. And the child went back to the seat and redid the problems. And all of the problems were correct the first time, but they were wrong the second time. And my brother told me, said, if the child really knew the process, they would have known they were correct the first time.
Sure.
Don't get upset with the teacher. The child didn't really understand the process, and that was the problem. I understood him clearly, because when you know something, no one can turn you around unless they can give you data to show that there's something wrong with the system that you've used. When you've been taught to make those kinds of decisions, and of course we have exceptions to all rules, but when you've been taught, when you know how to write and you write, and someone tells you that your writing is incorrect, because you understand the process, you will know whether or not that individual is giving you good advice or poor advice.
Absolutely. You're exactly right. And I run it to my daughter every now and then. So she says, Dad, that's not right. I think this is the right way. So I get it. So we're going to take a quick break. And so after the break, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Jackie Franklin regarding February Black History or His Story. Feel free to call us at 310-861-2331 or log on with us our live chat room at Blog Talk Radio, and we'd love to hear from you. So, again, the number is 310-861-2331, and we'll continue our dialogue after the break. This is On Cue. I'm your host, Eric Powell. We'll be right back.
Do you know God has called you? Do you know your purpose? Let us help you get on cue. How do you lead a people who are starved, who are broken, who are desperate?
You lead them where they are, by getting them on cue for God's will, by getting them on cue with His calling on their lives. Let us help you get on cue.
Who is your leadership? Do people trust you? Would people follow you if you were not their boss, not their parent, not their sibling, not their commanding officer? Let us help you get on cue.
And we're back. Thanks for staying with us. You're listening to On Cue. I'm your host, Eric Powell. Our mission here is simple, to equip leaders to help them lead where they are by getting them on cue with God's will and his purpose. So thanks for staying with us. We're tackling the question of the day, February Black History or History. We have Dr. Jacqueline Franklin, who's a retired professor of social science at Jackson State University. And Jackie, thanks for staying with us and joining us. It's been a delight so far. Before we jump into the next set of questions, we have some callers in, Jackie, and I think we have a few that want to ask a question of you. So can we bring the first one in? Who's on?
Okay.
You're on cue? Who you on? Okay, guess we missed that
Hello?
One. There's a little technical difficulties, and let's go to the next one, Kennedy. You're on cue. You got any questions for Dr. Jackie?
Hello?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes. My name is Nehemiah Smith. And I was calling because I was listening to Dr. Jackson, and what I found is that she's right about this thing. When I was teaching English, I taught grammar. I was heavy on grammar because if you don't have a good grammatical foundation, you can't do anything else. If you don't know how words function in sentences, it's just not going to work for you. You're not going to read well. You're not going to write well. And I taught seventh grade, and when my kids moved on to the next class, there was a teacher who was giving them bad information. But they were so solid in what they knew was right from what I had taught them that there was nothing that this man could say that they believed. As a matter of fact, one kid stood up in the classroom and told him, "You don't know what you're talking about." He was that bold because he was
very
confident.
Good.
Before I got there, they had no confidence whatsoever. I gave them the confidence that they needed. I showed them. I said, "Hey, you can do it." I had three levels. I taught everybody the same thing, and I used to walk down the halls and I would scream out prepositions. And at first, they didn't understand what that meant. Then one kid got it. Oh, he wants us to give a definition. Oh, I know what that is, Smith. And he would give the definition. But this man, they literally made sure that this man lost his job because they told the principal, "This man doesn't know. Mr. Smith has given us what we need to move, and this man doesn't know what he's talking about."
I'm not advocating students.
And I'm not advocating that either.
But I truly am happy to hear that that's where we want our students to go to be. We want them to get to the point where they have ownership of the
that's
process
right.
that they're learning.
Right.
And that they're the different grades are not repeated every year, but there are intellectual leaps that our students are making, and
that's
that we're
right.
making contributions rather than just regurgitating materials.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. I'm very, very excited to hear about that.
Thank you. Thank you, Nehemiah. Thanks for chiming in. It was a great question, great comment. Kennedy, do we have anyone else on? Is that it? Okay. I think that so Dr. Franklin, thanks for allowing us to throw a wrench in there. So we'll always try to bring and let everyone be participatory in this process, right?
Oh,
and
great.
And so
I'm really happy to have had the opportunity. I thought that probably we would have a few more questions.
No, we're going to continue with our questions. Now, we're not done yet.
Okay.
I'm not done
okay.
with you yet.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm sure a few people will call in, but I have a few more as well, and that may spark some other interest as we kind of go through. You know, we talked about the systems, the functioning. We talked about the processes, the resources, and you hit on the word earlier, utility. In order to sustain something once you put something in place. You create a foundation, and then that whole system, that process and the resources is the utility, therefore moving a process forward. And so as I look at what the basis of Q leadership and curriculum, as I shared, is based on the book of Nehemiah, and where, you know, Nehemiah developed an institution, in a sense, that really hold true to this day. And even to your point of understanding the whole economic piece of that, there's some steps he took in order to secure that. Now, the economic piece was the very first thing he did, once he started building the wall, was he secured the fish trade and the spice trade in order, he didn't necessarily focus on the other pillars just yet, but he needed to know that he needed the resource in order to sustain this. But my question really goes to, you know, tell us more about the need to develop institutions, you know, that the parallel that the Jewish community or other communities have done in order to really sustain people as we try to fix some of these issues we've talked about.
Well, if we look at the contributions of our Jewish brothers and sisters to colonial America and how the itinerant stores that they truck, almost like truck stores that they had during the early parts of this country, and how those have manifest themselves into major businesses and corporations, we can learn a lot from them. And I just take the entity, I'll just use one entity like Spiegel's, the store, was started basically with almost like an itinerant merchant. But my point is that if we look at others in our history, I started to talk about a man who's a physician, and his name was Rivers Frederick. I attended a junior high school that was named for his honor, in his honor. And what he did prior to Rivers Frederick's leaving New Roads, Louisiana, and moving to New Orleans, the black physicians did not have a place to practice. Now, I don't want to sound like I'm an expert on the history of black physicians, but all I want to do is make the point that Rivers Frederick made to the history of New Orleans. He eventually started a hospital in New Orleans called Goodrich. Eventually became Flint Goodrich. But that hospital was effective until 1980. That hospital went out of existence because of the lack of sustainability. That cannot continue to happen. If we look at the number of historically black institutions that we had at the let us say in the 1930s, and we compare that number today, we've lost quite a few. Now, my point is that with the need for education in America, we ought to be talking about expanding or increasing institutions of education rather than diminishing them. But we have to be able to learn how to sustain them. In reality, if we have a society that demands that the masses are educated, then we know everyone can't go to a few select schools. But English is English, math is math, science is science. You can teach it anywhere, and especially now with technology.
Sure.
So the need for sustaining institutions becomes mandatory in a participatory democracy. But let me talk about the problems with the lack of utility. There are some people who would have us be challenged by logic. For example, I don't know if you remember the pet rock.
Yes,
no utility in that pet rock. Absolutely
right.
None, other than someone giving it meaning that was meaningless. But the marketing was done so effectively that people used to have pet rocks on their desks in their homes. And that to me makes absolutely no sense. A person who understands the utility of a pet would know that that rock is very difficult to fall in that category. In addition to that, if you look at the clothing styles that were popular 10, 15 years ago, with holes in them. They look like parents had made errors and placed bleach in a machine that shouldn't have had bleach. And someone marketed that as stoneware. And the new idea of having a hole in your pants or your skirt or your blouse was somebody's ability to take an entity that has no utility or very little utility and turn it into something that is marketed for them. My point is that when we have children who and people who are learned or at least are taught, they would know then that there's something wrong with that entity. It's and I don't want to go into the music industry.
Yeah, I understand. Go ahead.
We would know if something has benefit to a society versus non-benefit and no benefit.
If it has utility,
it would uplift us. If it doesn't have utility, it diminishes us.
So 2 points I want to hit there is one, having logic in your utility in order to have sustainability at the end of the day. So we talked about some of the elements around education that kind of diminishes our ability to really ask the right questions in order to understand there's logic in a pet rock or any whatever utility we're using. But then the second piece, I want to pick up the sustainability piece. You know, we talk about it all the time in any type of corporation, any type of strategy, organization, in my business all the time about transformation, about sustainability, if it's around energy or if it's around some specific programs in within the corporation. But what I've found, though, Dr. Franklin, is that lots of times, no matter what the – there's a lot of problems that go awry within these initiatives. But what I've found is that it also starts with the leader, with the person who is moving trying to create some utility or trying to create some sustainability approach within whatever the problem is. So how – going back to the whole element about Black history and about the problems in the community and so forth, how have the leaders fared? I have my own opinions about it, but I want to get your perspective. How have the leaders fared in not supporting the right utility and not supporting sustainability in order to kind of move a people from one condition to the other?
If I could talk about the bottom 25% of America, where I come from.
Sure.
If we look at the population above the bottom 25%, the resources there won't have the same kind of effect. But if you let me talk about that bottom 25%, that bottom 25% is in need of an almost demand effective leaders. Even though people talk about how poorly the public schools were in America, the public schools brought a people who were from that bottom 25%, brought them out of poverty and into a whole nother dimension of this society based on the skills and the knowledge that they taught. Now, my point is that was because of effective leaders. I can talk about some of them. There was a woman, my elementary school was named for a woman by the name of Valina C. Jones. Mm-hmm. Now, I was shocked one day. I attended a funeral in Jackson, and I was reading the obituary of the wife of this professor of mine, of a friend of mine. And his wife attended Valina C. Jones School in Biloxi, Mississippi. And I knew that Valina C. Jones was the wife of a Methodist Episcopal minister who did a lot of work in New Orleans, and for that they named the school that I attended as an elementary school child for her. But what I learned when I investigated this woman more was that she was an unbelievable teacher in Biloxi, and that she moved from Biloxi and also moved to New Orleans and became the teacher of the year at the school eventually eventually they named a normal school for her, which was the way we produced teachers at a point up until the late 1930s in this country. But my point is that the work that this woman did. Now, I'm in the archives one year, I'm in the archives at Jackson State, and I'm going through the works of the organization of teachers that they were discussing problems between states, Louisiana and Mississippi, and I locate a document called the Bulletin. And on the top of that bulletin are given the names of the officers. The president of that organization at the time that was talking about improving education in the South was a man by the name of Joseph S. Clark. I attended Joseph S. Clark Public High School in New Orleans. Joseph S. Clark became the president of Southern University, but he was also the president of this organization that was working with teachers in the state of Mississippi and the state of Louisiana, looking at how they could better prepare students for the world that they were going to face. The other interesting thing was that the woman who was my principal when I was at Valina C. Jones, Fannie C. Williams, was the secretary.
Okay.
And I'm saying to myself, these, and I didn't find these persons in regular. You know, you have to remember the time, and we have to remember that we lived in a society where we had dual everything. But those individuals and the work that they did didn't make Fidel Te Kappa the record. It wasn't an article in the Instructor. You know, for the most part, they were going to produce their own documents, or we might see them in Ebony, or we might see them in old Negro Digest, or either the document that the NAACP used to produce, The Crisis. But my point is that if we don't know that these entities exist, and if we don't go looking for them, then we'll never know what contributions that folk made and helped us to move from one point to another. The point I'm trying to make is that we had a lot going on in public education. The reason why folk were successful was because we had people who were trying different techniques, who were sharing ideas with each other. They were successful. Unfortunately, their stories didn't get written by the people who actually circulated that information, and some of us unfortunately don't know what they did. So let me go back to the point I was trying to make. That bottom 25%, and even today, that bottom 25% need people who are skilled, professionals who are skilled, not people who are who feel for them. It's okay to feel for somebody, but it's more important to have the skills to help that person caliper themselves out of the depression that they might be in. I would tell my students, if two things would happen if I fell out with a heart attack or had some problem in the classroom, I'd have to find somebody who was willing to help me, but that person who was willing to help me had to have the skills to be able to help me. Because
Absolutely. If
they weren't willing and if they didn't have the skills, I would die.
Yep.
And that's the same thing in our society today. And the unfortunate thing about it is that too many of our parents are getting tied up and hooked up on grades. It's not grades are important. Don't let me explain to you that I think grades are not important.
They're more about that point.
The skills are more important. The skills are more important. The grades can affect you adversely. Don't let me lie.
Mm-hmm.
But the skills are more important than the grades. And until we get ourselves to look back, to go back and deal with skills and knowledge and right attitudes, until we do that, we live in a society where some teachers will give the grades necessary to keep the parents off their backs. That's not the kind of institutions we want.
You alluded to a few things, a few points there. One of the reasons our ministry exists is to really try to help get people, always talk about a different lens, equip them in order to really lead where they are. Also, those people that you describe from Ms. Belinda C. Jones or Joseph S. Clark's All of those individuals chose to lead and make an impact where they are. They didn't have to wait to some big resources. Some they use what they have in order to uplift people. And so how do we, well, I guess the question is, how do we incent that? How do we make the, instead of saying the intellectual leap, but how do we make the service leap, especially from getting people from the mindset of having to focus on those leaders that are on the front of our televisions every day, but it really where the rubber meets the road, that the fabrics, that those interfaces you talked about within those pillars, where we need to stand a post. How do we get to those individuals to really start turning this around?
I think we teach in social studies the importance of painting in society. You know, for so long, parents saw social studies grades as just insignificant grades. I would submit to you, and I would submit to parents who are listening, that the most important grades that your children get in school are social studies classes grades. They tell you whether or not your child or your children are being prepared to become effective societal members. Those are very important skills. The problems that we have with violence within urban areas are basically social studies problems. They're problems that our children and ourselves, we have not learned to address effectively certain skills that would alleviate conflict, or that we would be able to come up with solutions to addressing long problems or historical problems. So again, none of these answers are simple, Eric. Nothing in the human scheme of things is simple. It's
yep.
It's a bit complex, but it can be solved. But it can be solved with planning and the correct organizations.
Exactly. So let me try to tie the social piece about the conflicts and the resolutions, and it's not under human element. That's for part of what the ministry is. You know, you could get along with what the Lord and kind of complete his story in lots of times, and we've seen over and over again of how things can be changed. But I want to go back to one of your points about the logic and utility, and you touched on the pet rock, you touched a little bit on the stonewashed jeans, and you skipped over the which is fine from the music perspective, but if you look at the music and clothing and as well as the whole culture that it provides, it creates a certain perception of getting back to what Black America is in some sense. And so my question to you, you know, I'm not saying it's universal, but how do we help shift a certain perspective of a story of these conflicts and issues to really being a one of victory? How do we really start moving this process to really make it glorify what the Lord has for a people, a nation, a world, more than just from the Black America perspective? What do we need to start doing?
I really and truly, and I don't know if this is going to sound like I'm answering your question, but I really and truly believe that we have to give opportunities to our younger members of our society to start helping us to solve problems. We can't keep holding on to positions and positions, whether or not they're within formal or informal organizations. We have to allow young people to start developing their leadership skills. We can only do that by allowing them to become leaders. Now, I'm not talking about just giving and putting them in positions, but allowing them to develop themselves and to move from one position to the other strategically. And that means that we need to look at some of the organizations within our community, and just like we do in families where we teach students to do certain jobs within the home, we have to start to allow youngsters to do gain access to those positions too. I have a son who keeps me grounded in terms of making sure that I understand that it's his time, and that these are the times that I should be watching him develop rather than trying to lead him. And my point is I think we need to do this more in the black community. We have too many children who are waiting too long to access leadership positions. And I think as good mentors, we need to be around to help them when they show us that they are learning and that they're doing what we wished for them to do. But without practice, and I mean practice with utility, we won't know. If we keep holding on to some of the positions that we have to the extent that they don't get a chance to fill those positions while we are still alive to be able to guide them and explain to them whether or not they're being right or wrong in their behavior, then we lose opportunities for them to grow and for them to understand the realities of society.
Absolutely. You know, when you talked about it, goes back to your skills point. When are we have the generation who's passing the baton, so to speak, are we passing the right skills? Are we passing the right elements to be in order to help this generation to be leaders at the end of the day in your mind? What more can we do?
It's like I'm really not suggesting that we put people in positions that they don't deserve to be in.
Sure,
I'm not suggesting that at all. But I am suggesting that we have young adults who have developed certain behaviors and certain skills that they deserve to start being given opportunities to expand their leadership. I was about to talk about my my church. I'm Catholic. I've been Catholic all my life, but I strongly believe that we have too many old people in the church leading the church. We need more youngsters in charge. And until we allow those youngsters to show their skills, we're putting our institution, our church, at a disadvantage, in my opinion.
And I think that's probably broader, more than just the Catholic Church. I think that's broad across many churches, in a sense, of not allowing certain people to explore their gifts that the Lord's given them. And we had talked some time ago about, you know, redefining our gifts in order to really make an impact in society. Can you talk a little bit around that? Because I think it correlates with the whole leadership element, give an opportunity to really lead and move our people or situation to one condition to the next.
Well, I don't know if I can say it any a different way other than we need, well, in my church, we have a very small number of priests, and we really have not developed an effective plan for involving married men as deacons. That needs to be done, but it needs to be done with young married men. To address some of the problems that we have in the church. I don't have any problems with the numbers of priests being limited. I don't think that number should be large anyway, and I don't even address the problems that we've had in the past with deviant behavior. But in terms of involving men in the church who are married, I think we need to be looking at an effective I think the church needs to look at an effective way of institutionalizing the process of becoming deacons and involving women in other aspects of the church, if we are going to allow the church to address the needs of the 21st century. And if we don't, we will have a very limited presence.
And it goes to the point of utility and sustainability. It goes right back to how you sustain this over a period of time.
And we need to look at different ways. I attended and I visited some friends in San Diego last August, and I attended Mary Magdalene the Apostolate, Catholic Church. It's not official, but where the priests are females, and they were ordained by elected bishops. Well, I don't want to go into that, but the point is that they're developing these women and one of the priests is married. Another thing. Now, I don't have any skills in this area either. I just happen to attend that.
So it goes to the point of ensuring that if we get back to really redefining, in a sense, our gifts, our leadership, our sustainability, always going back to making sure that we're participatory in whatever the issues are in order to move a people or a situation to one condition to the next. And as we, you know, we've gone around, but all these elements are still similar, even though we've talked about the church, but we started with Black history and so forth. There's still some need in order to really help the world understand that this is part of world history, going back to your point. This is American history and so forth. So if we go back to that, what is that one thing you will want the audience, our friends, to know about Black history that we haven't touched on now? You want to go back and just if there's one thing you want someone to recognize, maybe something you've already said, but open what we would leave.
Yeah, I just would like to reiterate the realities of our of human society that demands involvement. We can't have a society with passive entities. That the society we live in demands our involvement, and it demands the kind of reasoning that will be as close to right reasoning as possible, and that means that we have to study. Continue to bring different entities to the table in terms of making decisions. It also means that we need to involve more people in the decision-making process. If we really believe in this thing called a participatory democracy, then we really need to try and start to involve as many people as possible. I have a good friend that I taught 38 years with that we debated the whole notion of the talented 10th versus the talented 90th. Mm-hmm. Now, I put my faith in the talented 90th, but the talented 90th has let me down, and it's letting me down a lot. And it by that I mean that my colleague would tell me, you've been ill. Do you want a member of the talented 90th to be your physician, or do you want a member of the talented 10th to be your physician? Well, my reality would be that if the talented 90th are given opportunities to expand their skill levels, it really doesn't matter. My chances would be greater with them. But if they're not going to expand their knowledge base and their skills, then I'm in trouble.
Absolutely.
And that's what we need to teach each other. That we cannot sit and wait. We cannot allow other people to make decisions on the lives that we live. We have to look to ourselves as members of a community to be able to solve our problems. We didn't get to where we are now by just being passive. Wherever we are, we've gotten there because of involvement. Now, my position is that we need to utilize more of the population than we have. We really need to start to teach people that you can change your life. You can change your realities, but you have to be able to put in the time, and you have to be able to want to change.
Absolutely. And with that, we're going to thank you for...
I'm happy to have done whatever I've done.
This has been great for us. It's been an honor to have you, and a lot of nuggets in order to think about. We probably could go on for another hour or two, but we'll probably bring you on at another time in order to continue the dialogue. You've been wonderful, and a lot of rich dialogue. I can see Kennedy here saying,
"I'd like to recommend some
class,
other people
right?
later on too that I think you might want to involve." There are quite a few people in this country in different states that are really doing some things. I'd like to share some names and some address, telephone numbers with you, and maybe you can have them to bring their thoughts to your radio audience.
Absolutely. That's where we want to highlight people who are making an impact, who are in the trenches. That's where it's going to happen. It's not going to happen finding a leader from the big stage or so forth. It's going to be right there in our homes, in our community, moving a people forward, moving this nation, moving this world forward. So, yeah, I am definitely welcome. That's what we want to do. We want to hire those types of leaders. As you've talked about, that from the 7th Ward in New Orleans is absolutely a mandate for us to understand and highlight those types of leaders.
Great. Thank you very much again, Eric. I really appreciate you inviting me, and I thank you very much for the time.
Oh, absolutely. Hey, we love you. We love to hope to have you back.
I love you very much. And give the family my love also.
We'll do. Thank you.
Okay.
That was
Dr.
Jacqueline Franklin. And as I shared, and hopefully I didn't let you down, passionate, well-learned, committed, as she says. You know she's been pretty passionate about what she represented and really making an impact in this society as we go through. You know, there's been many questions we've talked about today about Black history, and I understand the indignity of being a descendant, the so-called indignity of being a descendant of a once enslaved people, humiliation of being feeling second class if it's in a grocery store or in a corporation or corporate boardroom or even in church at times. You know, there's anxiety of having some freedoms based on laws of a nation's rather than the hearts of his people. But I also understand that no one can get what the Lord has in store for me. And that participatory element that Dr. Franklin talked about is paramount as we do this, because once you participate, only we can miss it. So, you know, being Black or an American, yeah, of course, provides some element of shame for many generations, but ultimately, how to give individuals an opportunity to really make an impact, it starts with a testimony of faith and service and perseverance and triumph and love and togetherness, far greater than what the first generation of slaves could have imagined, or what my grandparents could imagine, or what Dr. Franklin's parents could imagine, and far greater than what we're praying for at the end of the day. And it's a testimony really not birthed in this whole element of fear or of idleness or shame, but rather than resolve of a good and faithful people that can stand opposed, in courage and faith and strength and sacrifice, as we heard with Dr. Franklin here today, and as well as if you look on the invitation for our radio show this week, the picture I put of that purposely to see the courage and strength of that person then attacked by a dog. It had to be, there had to be some person, there had to be some sort of strength, and it's not from human condition. That's only by the Lord. So as we want to recast a little bit of what we heard today, and you know, as we know, Nehemiah of course did what the Israelites of old, the Jewish leadership did from the post World War II, where the common ground was really surviving after that experience. The unified thought was around the proverbial book of never again, and ultimately equaled everyone in these institutions that Dr. Franklin has talked about. And with all the reasons to be shameless, generation strike, they were bold and unafraid and actually allowed people to participate in order to bring a people from one stake to the other. In order to get to that point, they had to be proper dialogue, had to be proper research, and had to be knowledgeable of the history in order to challenge, as Dr. Franklin talked about at the beginning, to challenge the things that are incorrect in order to get people involved and ultimately and be bold in doing that. So what do we do next when we talk about the black history? We started talking about today, there's different views and so forth associated with it, but it's not black history in my mind. And I think Dr. Franklin articulated that, and you may agree or disagree, but it is American history. It's a world history. So, but what do we do in order to move forward? It is time to really raise a fire among our leaders to have an honest dialogue, not to rehash issues, but really how do we go forward? And so how do we get over the whole perception of being untrustworthy or gangster or whatever that is from being loud and emotional in order to really participate in this nation and participate in this world in order to move it forward? So as we go through the next week or so, you know, what role do Black America play in the future of America? What was the last time we've served a help without expecting something in return? How do we kind of sacrifice? Dr. Franklin shared some stories today about different teachers and different influences in life. All those individuals gave without expecting something in return. If they did expect something in return, they expect you to pay it forward for the next generation. And so as it is time where we need to really join some hands and raise some leaders who not necessarily yearn to connect every issue to the whole movement of what Black America is and what was, but really connect it to the point of how do we move forward together and hand in hand. And so, yeah, there is some leadership, I believe, and we all probably know that have mishandled that whole baton from Dr. King into the next, but now it's time for the next generation to stand the post. And so next week we'll focus on how do we get somebody, get me to construct that bridge of healing, if you will, around those four pillars of society, or even around this whole notion of being victimized or for shame or fear, whatever the case is. This moment in time is ripe for the right leadership to heal a nation from all that we talked about or have had in this history. But more importantly, how does this history fit in his story, meaning the Lord's story? And I firmly believe that his story is not complete, and how the Lord equipped us with the full armor in order to fight the shame and fear of victimization, be victorious in all that we do, and start queuing up our families and communities and his story, and around common ground of healing the next generation for shame and fear, unifying the thought of making his story of victory and sacrifice for the next generation, and equally yoke our institutions with utility in order to be sustainable to help people leave where they are. So before I leave, I want to offer thanks to all of you who tuned in tonight. Please go out and like us on Facebook on Q Radio. Put us on your prayer list. Invite a friend to listen in to the show the next week or so, especially as we tackle the part two of February, Black History or His Story. Consider Q Leadership as your curriculum and training for your church, your home, or even your company. And a few things I always want to give out. I want to give honor and praise to Lord Savior Jesus Christ, who's moved us and moved this ministry forward. And those who tuned in, our special committed Dr. Jacqueline Franklin. She is phenomenal, as you probably heard. My producer, assistant Kennedy, who's keeping me online and task, and as well as keeping me focused, my better half, wife, and Ty, and my daughter, Carson, friends, family, mom, mother-in-law, everyone. I dedicate this show to those who are in the trenches, those who are unsung heroes, who are really making an impact on society, and don't stop doing what you're doing. If you'd like to be a sponsor, feel free to email me at onq@qleadership.com. This is OnQ. I'm your host, Eric Powell. Until next week.
How do you lead a people who are starved, who are broken, who are isolated?
You lead them where they are by getting them on cue for God's will, by getting them on cue with His calling on their lives. Let us help you get on cue.
How powerful is your leadership? Do people trust you? Would people follow you if you were not their boss, not their parent, not their sibling, not their commanding officer? Let us help you get on cue. Let us help you get on cue.